This is an interview with Governor Victor Atiyeh at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is February 16th, 1992.
15th.
Okay. And this is tape 23, side one. In our last conversation, we were talking about your election in 1978, and you had started to mention Paul Newman, who was a consultant on your campaign.
Yeah.
And you were going to tell me something more about him.
Yeah. Let me get the timing, because Hank Crawford, I mentioned his name, he was a lobbyist. Among his accounts was the Oregon Medical Association. And he talked to me during the session. Says, now, if you're going to run for governor, I suggest you use Paul Newman. I said, well, I don't want to think about it now. Back to where I was before. So afterward, I said, thought about it. Well, okay, we've got to start thinking whether I want to do it or not. And okay, let's talk to Paul. Well, he began to warn me about Paul. He was a little nervous. He said, now, Paul really is very, very good. But he described then Paul was representing, or at least speaking to, the American Medical Association. And here was this guy with a beard and frowsy hair and a t-shirt and beads and stuff, and he was talking to the American Medical Association. What really impressed Hank was that when he finished, here was this scrunchy-looking hippie-type guy. He had the doctor standing on their feet cheering.
Hmm.
So he's pretty impressed by that. Then Hank got nervous again, because Paul had, after we'd made arrangements to fly up there to meet Paul, Paul said, well, I've got a surprise for you. Now Hank is real nervous, because what kind of a surprise does Paul Newman have, you know? And he repeated about, you know, Paul's really very good, you know? And anyway, we landed. And Hank's looking for Paul. And pretty soon Paul shows up. He's clean shaven, his hair's combed, and he starts showing his Brooks Brothers credit card. That was the surprise.
I presume that was a welcome surprise.
Incidentally, I sent him a letter a while ago and just got an answer not too long ago, and boy, he's really with it. He belongs to Rotary and all kinds of things like that. But anyway, we ended up with Paul. Extremely bright man, and I wished really I had a tape recorder, because you hear a point that really is a smashing point, and by the time you try to write that down, he's got another one. You know, you just can't keep up. You got to tape it and slow it down a little and write it down. But he was very bright. I'll give you kind of a quick recap of the thing, because after we got going and we designed the campaign and all the rest of it, and had been going a while, and Paul Newman, who has been used to, he did work with some governor's election and congressional ones, and I'm sure senatorial races and things of that kind. He said to me, I don't recall at what point, Vic, he says, you're hokey. Well, he said, maybe Hokie's in this year, he says. and so I was, I guess, a different kind of candidate than he was used to.
He was from where?
State of Washington.
State of Washington, but he was familiar enough with what was going on in Oregon that you felt comfortable with him?
Yeah. Yeah, and not only that, he was very good on strategy, particularly good on ads. You know, how you put these things together. He visualizes it very easily. We had, again, I'm jumping a little because I don't recall the time, but one of the ads we had, we were calling the scratchy pen ad. And Paul Newman was describing this to us, and the whole idea is that here is a guy that's pretty thoughtful.
Huh.
And that he, you know, he thinks about things. And so the camera was going to kind of go around, you know. In the meantime, I'm there at this, you know, it's kind of darkened a little with just the light on the desk, and and I'm supposed to be writing as scratchy pen, you know. Well, your ballpoints don't scratch, so anyway, we did run the ad, but it wasn't, you know, he wanted to get the sound of a pen scratching. Well, we had to scrap that one because that just doesn't work. I think I told you earlier, recognizing, first of all, about the race. Did I want to get in? Yes. And that Bob Straub had a consultant from New York. I don't recall what his name was, but he was well known. And we realized that, as I mentioned earlier, that this fellow, he tries to sell his candidate via the ads, the media. That was his style. We knew that too. And we knew we had to raise money and try to match him with our, beat him with our volunteers, as I told you. Well, I wish I could remember. I think maybe Roger announced first, Roger Martin. I announced that I was going to run, if I recall, sometime the latter part of October. And if I remember correctly, Tom McCall announced, oh, I think the 1st of January, or anyway, after. Mm-hmm. And I might add, there was also four other candidates that were in that race, so there were seven of us. But the ones that got all the attention were Tom McCall, Roger Martin, and myself. One of the interesting sidelights of all of this was that there was a theory accepted, incidentally, by mutual friends of Roger and myself, that we would split the vote and that Tom McCall would thereby win. Mm-hmm. And that one of us ought to get out. There was some hint in the newspaper about this kind of thing going on. We actually met, Roger and I, in Woodburn, somebody's home. Now, it's interesting. I was kind of testy about the whole thing because in my mind always was that Roger was going to come in third. Mm-hmm. I didn't know who was going to come in first or second, but I knew Roger was going to come in third. But there was a whole speculation that I ought to get out of the race.
Because you had run before?
Well, because I'd run before and that Roger probably could, it was a better candidate, I don't know, for all the reasons. And we met subsequently with some mutual friends of ours who've been involved in, you know, politics. And they actually suggested that I get out of the race. I told him I didn't plan to do that, but there was that discussion going on that that one of us ought to get out of the race, and the one that ought to get out of the race was me. Anyway, the campaign proceeded. I do recall down in Newport, they have their Loyalty Day parade is still going on. So candidates are down there for the parade. Well, Tom McCall, being a former governor, he had his own car all by himself. The rest of us guys had to be in a flatbed truck. That means, you know, candidates for governor and county commissioner and sheriff and mm-hmm. city, whatever. Mm-hmm. We had to be on a truck, on a flatbed truck. Tom McCall's slogan was, "The best is yet to come." That was his slogan. My secretary then, Glenna Hayden, she was standing on the street there, and Tom comes by with his car, and his sign says, "The best is yet to come," and she yells at him, "That's right," he says, "The Picatinny is right behind you." Incidentally, my slogan in 74 was Oregon's next great governor. Mm-hmm. And I suggested that the campaign slogan in 78 should have been Oregon's next governor. Great. Well, they didn't go along with that one, but I thought it was kind of funny. The highlight of that campaign, well, I should tell you that There were a lot of people that made the same presumption that Tom McCall was going to be the winner, running against Bob Straub, and it was difficult raising money.
Wasn't there a threat of McCall possibly running as an independent?
Oh, there's always some talk about that. And he talked about the third force, and that was Tom.
But hadn't you said earlier that it was his great mistake not running as an independent? That the primary would have been harder for him than the general election? Somebody had told me that.
I don't know. That's a matter of judgment. He wouldn't, of course, run in the primary. It would have been Tom McCall, Bob Straub, and myself. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to tell what would have happened out of that pile. When one looks at the result of the general election, the primary election, with seven candidates, and including Tom McCall, Roger Martin, myself, and four others, and I ended up with 47% of the vote, almost 50% of the whole vote. Out of that whole pile. So, you know, it's hard to tell. If you say, okay, that's what happened in the primary election, Tom would have stood by himself in a general election. You know, how does that convert on the Democrats, Democrat and Republicans and independents voting? I don't know. I guess you could speculate that, but...
McCall and Straub being very similar in their ideologies probably would have had a good chance of splitting the liberal end of the ticket, or voters.
Yeah.
You had Denny Miles as a press aide during the campaign, and he later joined your staff.
Right.
Maybe you could tell me a little bit about him.
Denny came from Oregon State University and joined me when I was Senate Republican leader as the press aide. He took a, I don't know what you call it, leave or whatever they call it, and spent the session with me. Of course I knew Denny, and as we began our campaign, I'm chuckling now because I have to step back a little bit and I'll get more into detail of it. Punch Green was a mutual friend of ours, had a terrible time. That meets Tom McCall and myself. I finally decided to stay out, which is very tough for Punch Green to do. But he just didn't want to choose between Tom McCall and me.
Oh.
We started off with a real, I suppose some would call it amateurish thing. We did have Paul Newman. I had a campaign coordinator, not a campaign manager. Sort of an ad hoc finance committee. I did have a treasurer, which of course keeps track of all these things, the mechanical things that one does in the campaign. I had a volunteer for my volunteer group, counties and those kinds of folks. But it really wasn't what you call highly sophisticated as it developed later on in the campaign. But anyway, Danny came. At this point in time, he sort of abandoned ship. In other words, you can only do that so many times, leave and go work for a politician. And he was in the, I'm not sure what you'd call it, communication department or something at Oregon State University. He was a professor there and teaching radio, television. Mm-hmm. That was what he was doing at Oregon State. But when he decided, I asked him and he decided to come aboard, that meant he let go of the umbilical cord of OSU and just see what happens in the future. Denny, incidentally, as it all developed and over the years, because as you know, he was with me until I left office, I call him my in-house cynic. I'd say, now Denny, okay, now where's the landmine out there? what's about to happen? He's a very bright guy, and now he's in his own consulting business, doing fairly well, quite well, I guess, and not just necessarily political. There's a lot of operations that really don't know how to handle the press, how to establish a media contact. And so there's a lot of businesses that need the kind of talent that Denny brings. He's very bright, learned a lot over the years in our campaigns, and I like him very much. He, mm-hmm. We were quite compatible. Keep close touch today. Well, we began to establish the campaign. You start off with a plan. And that has to be central to any campaign if you have a chance of winning. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to really, you know, the plan can be a successful plan or an unsuccessful plan, but you have to have a plan. Mm-hmm. And in order to give yourself a chance of winning, you have to stay with that plan. Now, that may not sound like too much, but when you get in the campaign and you've got all your friends and they all call and say to you, now, if you just do this one thing, you're going to win, which doesn't necessarily match your plan. And so you have to have a plan. You have to know what you're going to do, and you have to stay with it. Mm-hmm. Now, you may take some side roads, but that's okay, as long as you're on the road and on the plan. Incidentally, by comparison, in 4 years ago, when Bush was running against Dukakis, Bush had a plan. I could tell that. And he was very consistent with the plan. He stayed with the plan all the way. Dukakis never quite had a plan. He was changing it almost daily or weekly, and also trying to decide who he should be. So he never really hooked on. You know, he really never had a good cohesive campaign. By contrast, I have a feeling that there wasn't really a plan with the Bush campaign this time, and Clinton had a plan, and he stayed with it. That's what I mean. Now you can begin to see what I'm saying. So with Paul Newman's advice, and you know, we established a budget which sounded awful high, and we had, you know, began to put a team together. I didn't have a whole set of highly professional people, just a bunch of dedicated people. Thinking of Sharon Page, for example, she was our volunteer coordinator, did one whale of a job. As a matter of fact, she did such a good job and had such a good plan together that when the campaign was over, Paul Newman, who really had complimented her highly, when I say took the plan, obviously he didn't steal it, we knew all about it, he said, now this is something that all campaigns ought to have. And so he used the format that Sharon put together. We had a large number of volunteers. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're still in the primary. The thing I knew, remember I told you Roger was going to come in number three?
Yes.
I also knew that Tom McCall could not match his image, and that he was going to come down. He'd have very high. He was, if I recall correctly, 60-some-odd plus percent, and I was under 30, 27, 28% or something like that. And I knew that he was going to come down, because the image of Tom McCall could not be matched by the real Tom McCall. The only question was he going to come down fast enough by primary day that I could catch him? Earlier we talked in the 74 campaign about conservative and all the rest. Big opportunity came when the three of us were going to debate. The first of them was at the City Club. We had one in Portland at the City Club, one in Eugene, and one in Medford. And really, I wasn't trying to make myself something I really wasn't, but the whole idea was designed that here would be Tom on the left and Roger on the right and Vicky in the middle. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't mean in terms of where you're sitting, I mean philosophically. And really, if we had written a script and said, now, Roger, you say this, and Tom, you say that, they couldn't have done a better job at it. And it was so interesting to me as I went to the debates, and then I'd read about in the paper the next day, and Roger said this, and Tom said that, and oh, by the way, Tia was there. And, but, I knew where we were trying to position ourselves in the eyes of people. Actually, it was finally capped by the time we got to Medford. Roger really took off on Tom, and Tom, you know, came shouting back, and I'm just sitting there holding their coats, you know. So that worked out extremely well. But the campaign was difficult in the sense that people that give me money in 74 were holding back, and I think I mentioned that earlier because they presumed it was going to be a McCall straw. Matter of fact, about a week before the election, the timber barons, so-called, in Eugene, had a appreciation dinner for Bob Straub. I was really ticked off about that. Because again, they were presuming it was going to be a Bob Straub, Tom McCall, and they were just jumping on board of Straub, and I was really pretty put out. It's interesting how quickly the cat can change the spots, because about a week after the primary, I had to had a meeting with the same people, and they abandoned the Straub ship rather quickly.
Which people were these?
Oh, I'd have to do some remembering on it. Certainly, I think Stubb Stewart had to be a part of it. Neil Holt, Justina, probably Aaron Jones. Those folks. Aaron Jones was very good. He loaned his airplane. Was quite helpful. But anyway, that's how those things change, and change rather quickly. I really had a feeling about the campaign. I really felt good about it, how things were going. And seemed to me I covered this, but on the Saturday before, not the Saturday before the Tuesday, but a Saturday, 10 days out, something like that. There was a poll, and it was an Oregonian poll. I remember they called me at home to get a response. And the poll said something like McCall was 38% and I was 31 or 32%, something like that. And they wanted my reaction. My reaction was, great, I've won. Now here I am, 6 or 7 points behind. But the point, I could tell the trends, and the trend was moving in the wrong direction for Tom and the right direction for me. That's the value of a poll. You know, what's a trend? What's going on? And as I told you earlier, I won by almost, I think it was senior year, if I remember, 47% of the whole vote, something like that. So when things sort of slide sometimes, they really slide, which incidentally happened in 82 as well, but we'll get to that.
Were there specific incidences that caused it to slide for Tom McCall?
No, I think it was mainly, I'm going to have to do some guessing. First of all, I think he thought that he was invincible. You know, I can't lose. I described it, many times, like he just, the curtains parted and he went, ta-da, and everybody cheered, that's the vision that he had in his mind. Probably didn't, campaign as hard because, why do I have to campaign too hard? I'm saving myself for the general election. That could have been part of it. Couldn't believe that Oregonians would reject him. Highly popular, which he was.
What kind of platform did he have?
I can't remember.
Was he just basically campaigning on his reputation, or did he have specific proposals?
I think so. I don't think he had any particularly new. The best is yet to come. We've done all these neat things, but we've got more things coming.
Right.
But when you ask me, I can't remember. I'm just so intensely involved in my own that I just didn't pay any attention. I knew what I wanted to do and what my plan was, which didn't relate to either anybody's plan. And the funny part of this whole thing was that Tom McCall's victory party was at the Benson Hotel. My victory party was at the Mallory. Did I tell you about this? It won't hurt to repeat
yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, please.
Isn't that the one up north?
On Yamhill and...
By the
Masonic Temple, exactly.
And, the media was no different than anybody else. They presumed that the action was down at the Benson where McCall was. So the first team was down at the Benson. And they had the second team up by my, you know, at the Mallory Hotel. Well, it became very evident this is not what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And it was the funniest scramble in the world. And I tell you, it was really funny. You know, of them trying to scramble to get to where the real action was, which of course was at the Mallory. It was really something. It was funny to see this whole happen. Roger Martin was very good. He didn't call or send a note. He came up to my headquarters. Huh. I mean, he came up to the victory party.
Huh.
And he said that was just a great victory. And I mean, he was just really very good about the whole thing. I kept waiting for Tom McCall to call, which is the standard thing, which had happened. Got a call from Mark Hadfield congratulating me. I said, Mark, you know, what do you do? I'm waiting for Tom McCall to call because it was clear, you know, he was not going to win. I don't recall I got much advice. I said, I'm thinking about maybe going over there myself. I don't recall what the discussion was, but anyway, I concluded after a while, I'm going to go down and see him, which is very unusual for the winner to go down and see the loser. And I was most concerned that we talked to each other privately, because I knew that Tom McCall losing was, you know, if I were to lose, it's like jumping out the second story window. For him to lose, it's like jumping out the Empire State Building. Well, unfortunately, when I got to the Benson Hotel, he was in the lobby, and the media was talking with him at that point in time. Well, now there's no escape. And there is some tape on this, and he was pretty petulant about the whole thing. And you could see that if you see the tape and Tom McCall talking. But then we left and went to his room. And he was... Well, it's a good thing the media didn't catch the display in the room. Mm. And he was really on his campaign manager, Kim Scarrett. Now, I know her by her prior name before she got married. Nice young lady. Really on her case pretty bad. And I had Steve Young with me as well. He was then the state... state chairman of the party. And he had Steve in tears. Now this is an adult male. And he had Steve in tears. Well, you know, it didn't affect me that much because I already knew this was going to be a terrible blow to Tom McCall and his ego. And I just remember the event. I didn't feel hurt. I wasn't in tears. I just knew that's unfortunately Tom McCall. And that, you know, he calmed down after he wouldn't ever get over it, but that, you know, he'd have his emotions a little more in check. As much as Tom McCall can put his emotions in check. But that was a kind of a you know, rough night for him, and he was kind of swinging pretty wild at that point.
Do you remember things that he said at the time?
No.
What was his attitude?
I remember that he turned to Kim and said to her it was her fault that he lost. I remember that. Beyond that, what led to the tears, I can't...
What were the nature of his comments to you?
Well, all I can remember is down in the lobby, well, we've just given the governorship to the Democrats, something like that. Something about negative campaign or something. But, you know, I was really wanting to stop the conversation. I didn't want to get into it in the first instance. And so I wasn't really anxious to spend a lot of time debating that with him in the lobby of the Benson Hotel. Not for myself, mostly for him.
What was the context of the conversation you had with him?